Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Regina. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to this program, this Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, which is done in collaboration with Stupid Cancer Organization. And they will be speaking during the program as well. Many of you may be familiar with them. You're going to learn more about them as the program goes on. And today's program is titled Challenges Young Adults with Cancer Face, Coping Tips. And this is part one of a two-part series of young adult survivorship. And today's program is made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc. and ISI, Inc. We want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, we have a lot of you on the call today. There's over 210 participants on the call today. And you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Algeria, Canada, India, Pakistan, the Philippines, Romania, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And I credit you that you've each chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to choose our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Julia Glade Bender. Dr. Bender is Vice Chair for Clinical Research, Department of Pediatrics, member Sarcoma Service Rare Tumors Program, co-medical director Lisa and Scott Stewart, Center for Adolescent and Young Adult Cancers, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Bender will be addressing overview of young adults living with cancer, including delays in diagnosis, where to seek cancer treatment, selecting your oncology healthcare team, including young adult cancer programs, and managing post-treatment side effects, late effects, coping with concerns about cancer recurrence. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bender.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to speak with you today. One of the things that Carolyn did not mention is that I'm also the mother of five young adults, ages 23 to 32. So this is very important to me. In the cancer world, the definition of an adolescent young adult is ages 15 to 39 diagnosed with cancer. That's a big age range, and we can all agree that, you know, a 15-year-old and a 39-year-old don't necessarily have that much in common. But one thing they have in common is that they are members of the cancer community that is rare. So there are about 90,000 new cases of cancer in people under the age of 40 in the United States. This represents only about 5% of cancer diagnoses in the United States, but it is the number one leader in death in this age group, and so it's a really important problem. There are a number of diseases that are really restricted to this age group. Some of them are pediatric diseases that happen in adults. Some of them are young onset adult cancers that have a very different biology. And some of them are what we would consider to be classic AYA diseases, diseases that really happen at this important point in life when you're developing from a child into a adult into a middle-aged adult. And those are leukemia and lymphoma, testicular and germ cell tumors of the ovary, thyroid cancer, sarcoma, neuro-oncology brain tumors, breast cancer, and now, unfortunately, colon cancer as well. And the incidence of this young onset of adult cancers that tended to be associated with aging are actually happening with alarmingly more frequency, and there's intensive research as to why that might be. because it is so rare, it is really important that adolescents and young adults advocate for their medical needs. If something feels off, if you've been to a number of doctors and they don't seem to get it and they don't address your problems, you need to advocate for yourselves, because adolescent young adults often have delays in diagnosis, mostly because the doctors are right. They don't think of it. It's not at the top of their list to think of cancer in a young person. And generally, the cancer presents with common symptoms, headache, constipation, but not, or, you know, some back pain, generally not a mass that you notice. So the biggest problem, I would say, in part, is the issue of access to doctors and fractured care. At this age, you know, many people are transitioning either from school to work, or they're transitioning between jobs as they find, their calling, or they're moving around the country, and it causes some instability. So not everybody has stable insurance. They may be transitioning off of their parents' insurance. And generally speaking, patients in this age range don't have a regular doctor. Young adults are on the move, and they usually use urgent care, and they see several doctors. So it's really hard for the doctor because they don't get a sense of the patient. They don't know if they're a complainer or almost never complain. And so it's really unusual. They don't get to see symptoms evolve. It's really hard when a young adult seeks information from one doctor, doesn't like what they have to say, goes to another doctor. And that also leads to very poor communication and difficulty putting a record together. So it's hard to make a diagnosis without sort of the longitudinal follow-up, if you will. And it's hard to put the records together once you do come up with an idea. So my first take home is advocate for yourselves, and then make sure you get copies of everything that happens before you have cancer, or make sure you can find it in a patient portal, because this will really save time and also reduce the number of times that you have to have a similar test over and over again. Once you have the cancer diagnosis, the next issue is, where do you seek treatment? And I think that depends a lot on the diagnosis. As I mentioned, not all diagnoses are the same. So some diseases are more frequently seen in children but happen in adults, and that patient may be better seen in a pediatric setting. And yet there are also very young teenagers, for example, that have diseases that as a pediatric oncologist, I really don't treat, like breast cancer, colon cancer, gastric cancer. And so I really need the help of a medical oncologist. In addition, those classic AYA diseases like Hodgkin's disease, sometimes the pediatric regimens, actually most of the time, the pediatric regimens work better than the adult regimen. So you need a doctor who's aware of that and will use the most intensive regimen, and make sure that if not, that you're getting more than one opinion. When you select a healthcare team, you also want to have access and support. So not all diagnoses are the same, not all patients are the same, and it's certainly not defined by age. So, for example, you can have a 26-year-old who's married with two kids and has done a tour of duty in the armed services, or you can have a 26-year-old who's living with their parents, not quite sure what they want to do with their lives, and those are very different people. So some 26-year-olds with a pediatric sarcoma will do better in pediatrics, and some really need the adult environment. When you speak to the doctor, it's important to share who you want in the room and how much detail do you want to know. Do you want statistics? Do you want to see pictures of your scans? And how independent do you want to be on your parents, on your spouse, on your intimate partner? And do you want them in the room when you talk? And if the doctor doesn't ask you these questions, that's probably a sign that there may be a problem. questions are what we want to hear, especially when you're choosing a therapy. You want to ask what the doctor thinks is best and maybe ask for references. Have they discussed it with colleagues? And, you know, should I get a second opinion? Always talk out loud about second opinions because, you know, doctors know each other. We know who's good, who's not good. And if they agree with us, great. And if they don't, let's figure out why we might have different opinions. Clinical trials are the way that we make progress in cancer. And the AYAs, the adolescent young adults and young onset, because they're on the move, often don't enroll in clinical trials. And this is in part why progress has lagged in this age group, and the National Cancer Institute has made a real mandate to try to get more adolescents and young adults on clinical trials. They are not, clinical trials are generally when you're first diagnosed, best standard of care versus something we think might be better. But the answer is might be. It may be more toxic. It may be less effective. We just don't know. If we knew the answer to the question, it would be unethical to do the trial. So if a clinical trial is offered to you, generally speaking, that is the state of the art. And you will not only be getting the state of art care, but you'll also help us make strides for adolescents and young adults. Medical centers are big, and big medical centers often have a lot of the specialty expertise and broader offerings of subspecialty services, but they can be hard to navigate. And so it's important to figure out, if you're at a larger center, who is the quarterback who's helping you navigate care? Maybe it's a nurse navigator, maybe it's a social worker. This is one area where AYA programs can be super helpful in terms of telling you who is the person that you should contact if you're getting lost in a big system. There are also issues about, all of the things that we'll hear about today. You know, who do I speak to about insurance coverage, and who do I speak to about side effects and managing side effects, and what kind of support systems are available? And these are issues that tend to be addressed by adolescent and young adult cancer programs. Sometimes AYA programs really focus on fertility, and it's a good start, but there are lots of other issues. But speaking about toxicity upfront and managing things like fertility are really important. You should know whether the therapy you're receiving could affect your ability to have children and what are your options. If someone doesn't speak to you about sperm banking or saving freezing eggs, that should be a sign of a problem. There are other side effects like neuropathy, strange feelings in your fingers and toes, hearing loss. There may be options to mitigate some of those long-term side effects. And you, again, need to advocate for yourself about those things. There's a, you know, classic story of musicians who, when hearing about their side effects, have actually opted for a different therapy. So again, ask questions, empower yourself. Ask if there's a local AYA program, because in terms of coping with these all of this stress, they can offer support groups and generally lots of resources within the community, like those that are sponsoring today's webinar, so that it's important to ask to be looped into these programs, most of which are virtual. And then the one last thing that I'd like to address and will be addressed subsequently is that the next most stressful time when you are being treated for cancer is when you finish the active therapy. And that sounds counterintuitive to most, but that's really a very anxiety-producing time. Patients tell me that they feel like they're flying without a parachute. That's when the sort of real gripping issue of, is this cancer going to come back, really takes hold. And every scan is a source of anxiety and anticipatory anxiety. We call it scanxiety. It's a real thing. And again, this is an area where I think that adolescent young adult programs and having a peer group to talk to are so very important. I think that was most of what I wanted to say about the general issues around active cancer diagnosis and therapy.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bender. That was a superb presentation, really stellar. And we really covered a lot of very important topics, really set the stage for today's program. Just did a wonderful, presentation. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And thank you for setting the stage for today's program and highlighting so many important issues. And our next speaker is Dr. Sarah Monique. And Dr. Monique is Hematology Oncology Fellow, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Monique will be addressing the importance of treatment summaries, follow up with your oncologist and primary care doctor, dealing with physical changes due to cancer in its treatment or its treatment, talking with the healthcare team about survivorship questions and concerns, and working during cancer treatment with suggestions from the healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Monique.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Monique. It's so nice to be here today. Today we're going to be talking about those four key topics that were already introduced to help you navigate life during and beyond treatment. The first topic we're going to be talking about is the importance of a treatment summary. So this is a document that records your diagnosis, your treatments, and follow-up care recommendations from your oncologic team. It's extremely important for ensuring smooth transitions between your specialty doctors, or doctors in the future, because we know the AYA group is a very mobile group. And for monitoring long-term effects, like issues with your heart health or bone health, you can kind of think of it as a roadmap for your medical future. There are a few key components that every good treatment summary should include. First, and probably the most obvious, is going to be your cancer diagnosis. So this should include your date of diagnosis, the type of cancer you had, the stage at which you were diagnosed, and any genetic testing results that might impact future risks. It should also include a detailed summary of the treatments you've received. So this can include things like surgeries, systemic therapies, of which there are now many, things like chemotherapy regimens, immunotherapies, targeted therapies, cellular therapies, including things like stem cell transplants or hormonal therapies. It should also include radiation if you received it. And for each treatment, we want to know the dates that you received it, the dosages that you received, the locations where you got this treatment, and who the doctors administering it were, as well as any complications related to your treatments. This is really important information because things like treatments, dosages will inform potential late effects that are going to be really important for your care teams, including your primary care doctors, to look out for. And so that's another very important part of these treatment summaries, and some might argue one of the most important parts. These areas where we list potential late effects are truly going to be individualized based on your prior treatment exposures and any potential genetic testing that you've had done. In this section, it should include what screening tests are needed and what we're actually monitoring for, how frequently these tests need to be done, and which provider is going to be responsible for ordering them. Are you going to be someone that has the ability to follow up in a survivorship clinic where they're kind of taking ownership of ordering these things on an annual basis? Or are we moving around and really your primary care doctor is going to be taking ownership over it? So having that designation in the treatment plan is really important to make sure that nothing slips through the cracks. In addition to monitoring for potential late effects, many of us will have required to have specialists throughout the course of our care that we're going to continue to need to follow up with. And so there should be a section that includes follow-up care plans, and that's going to include who you're following up with and the frequency at which you're seeing these individuals. And lastly, another important part of treatment summaries are going to include a section about health promotion. So this can include things like lifestyle recommendations to reduce risks of late effects and to promote your overall well-being. Many cancer centers provide these. If you're treated in a pediatric cancer center, they are particularly good about making sure their patients leave with a treatment summary in hand. On the adult side, it can be a little bit hit or miss, I will be completely honest. So if yours doesn't, ask for one and make sure it's kept updated. This is really going to be as essential as a passport for you. And if your oncologist tells you, I don't know how to make one of these, Children's Oncology Group has really excellent resources that apply to the adolescent and young adult population to help oncologists and care providers generate comprehensive treatment summaries. Kind of transitioning from treatment summaries, we can move on to how we talk with our healthcare teams about survivorship. Survivorship isn't just about completing treatment. It is about navigating life during and after treatment with confidence. And your healthcare team is here to support you 100%, but survivorship care truly is a partnership and requires active engagement between patients and their care teams so we can address your concerns, help you set goals, and move forward with clarity and support. So there's a couple ways to effectively approach these conversations. One of which, and this applies to many doctor's appointments, is prepare your questions in advance. Write down your concerns or topics you'd like to discuss. This can include things like what late effects you might be at risk for and what signs or symptoms you can look out for in yourself. It can include things like fertility and family planning, mental health resources, because we know that that transition to survivorship can be really difficult. We go from having very frequent visits when we're on treatment with our oncologists to all of a sudden having visits that are quite spaced out, every 3 months, every 6 months, sometimes annually after that. And that can be really difficult because we no longer have that tight support network. And then also talk to your doctors about what kind of lifestyle changes you can make to help reduce future risks. It's important to be specific about your goals. These are going to be individual. It can be returning to school or work, improving your energy if you're dealing with fatigue, or starting a family if that's a goal of yours. Share your priorities because it helps your care team create a plan that fits your needs. And it's really important to not shy away from important topics. So subjects like body image, sexual health, and mental health can feel sometimes difficult to bring up. But I promise you, your team has heard it before, seen it before, and helped someone before. And we want to help connect you with the appropriate resources to help deal with these kinds of issues. If it feels too overwhelming or uncomfortable to talk to your doctor about this in person, you can always shoot us a message through your clinic's patient portal, and that lets us know that we should be the one to bring it up with you in clinic to take off some of that burden to you. So this is a good segue for transitioning into coping with some of the physical changes that can be caused by cancer or cancer treatment. So cancer treatment can bring about significant physical changes. Some of these are temporary, and others can be long-lasting or permanent. Some changes can include fatigue, hair loss, weight changes, including weight loss or weight gain, scars from procedures, hormonal shifts, and even more permanent changes like an ostomy if that's required or an amputation. Having these changes happen to your body can be really difficult to navigate, especially when they impact how you see and view yourself. So ways that we can deal with this is to explore options for targeted support. Ask about resources like physical therapy that can help you regain strength and muscle mass. Or ask for dermatology consults if you're someone that might be dealing with GVHD of the skin to see how they can help. Nutrition counseling can also be extremely helpful with weight management or dealing with specific dietary needs after treatment. And don't underestimate the power of peer support groups. Connecting with others who have experienced similar changes can provide encouragement, practical tips, and a sense of community, and give you some sense of perspective about how our view of our body can change over time. And make sure to seek out professional guidance. If you need help, ask for it, because your doctors won't always know that you're struggling if we aren't able to have honest conversations. Psychologists or counselors or social workers who have expertise in adolescent and young adult cancer care can help you process feelings of loss, frustration, or self-consciousness. And remember to celebrate small victories. Focus on what your body has endured and overcome. Finding clothes or accessories or makeup that make you feel good can be a confidence boost. And acknowledge that healing is often nonlinear and takes time. It's okay to grieve changes while working toward a positive self-image. Open conversations with your healthcare team, loved ones, or a therapist can help you rebuild your confidence and redefine what beauty and strength means to you. The last section we're going to be touching on today is working during cancer treatment. Balancing work and cancer treatment can definitely feel overwhelming, but with thoughtful planning and some support, it can be possible for some. And taking proactive steps can help you maintain your career while also prioritizing your health. So we're going to talk about some practical tips for managing work and treatment. First and foremost is communicate with your employer. Sharing your treatment schedule and health needs with your supervisor or HR department will be helpful to identify workplace policies that exist to support employees that are undergoing medical treatments. Don't be afraid to request accommodations to make work more manageable. This can look like adjusting your work hours, reducing your workload, or shifting to remote work. And be honest about your limitations while emphasizing your commitment to maintaining your job. Another way that we can help you maintain ability to work, if that's something that is important to you during treatment, is working with your care team to be strategic about your treatment schedule. Oftentimes, scheduling treatments later in the week, if you're someone that works Monday through Friday, like on a Thursday or Friday, will give you the weekend to rest and recover and rebuild your energy before returning to work on Monday. Discuss these options with your healthcare team to see if it's possible. The next thing is it's really important to understand your rights, and this is going to be a whole other topic that we'll kind of dive into in a little bit more detail, but learn about your workplace protections that are available to you under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires employers to provide reasonable accommodations, and familiarize yourself with the Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA, which, if you're eligible, allows employees to take unpaid leave while protecting their job security. And make sure that you consult with your HR or a legal expert if you need help understanding or asserting these rights. The last tip is figure out ways to work smarter, not harder. This often means prioritizing your energy and scheduling your most critical or demanding tasks when you feel the most energized. For many, this is going to be first thing in the morning or early in the day, but that's not the case for our night owls, so keep that in mind. And figure out ways to stay organized to combat things like fatigue and chemo brain. Use digital or physical task managers to outline your daily activities and weekly goals to help reduce your mental load or clutter while you're dealing with side effects like mental fogginess from chemo brain or just feeling really tired. Figure out how to delegate efficiently. Ask for help from colleagues when it's possible and work with your team to create contingency plans for unexpected absences. And remember to take restorative breaks, short, frequent breaks to allow you to rest, stretch, or practice mindfulness can help prevent fatigue and boost focus throughout your workday. But it's important to remember that even with good planning and extra time off, you might find that working is still too much to keep up with during cancer treatment, and that is okay. If you find that you can't keep up with the demands of your job while getting treatment, be proactive and talk with your supervisor. Explain that you want to keep working, but right now you need to take time away from work. You can consider part-time work if that's something that is feasible for you and your work offers, or consider disability benefits through your work. Your health should always come first. So in closing, I want to emphasize that knowledge is power, and this is the whole point of this teleconference today. Whether it's keeping a treatment summary, managing physical effects, talking openly with your healthcare team, or finding some balance in work, these tools are here to support you. Your treatment team is here to support you. And for caregivers, your role in advocating and supporting your loved one is entirely invaluable. Together, you form a team with healthcare providers and patients undergoing treatment to ensure the best possible outcomes. Thank you everyone for your time today, and I'm happy and looking forward to answering questions or directing you to resources as able during the Q&A later.
Thank you so much, Dr. Monique. That was really, again, stellar, just a wonderful presentation covering a lot of different topics. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. Thanks a lot for all that you've presented today. And our next speaker is Ms. Deborah Wolf. And Ms. Wolf is a lawyer, and she is a senior supervising attorney, Legal Health New York Legal Assistance Group, NYLAG. And Ms. Wolf will be addressing financial concerns, including health insurance coverage, school, college, and career, knowing your rights under the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, Family Medical Leave Act, FMLA, and additional legal protections, choosing who and what to tell others in terms of disclosure. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And I'm very pleased to be a part of this workshop with Cancer Care and Stupid Cancer. I'll first be speaking about health insurance, and to understand your coverage, it's important to know that there are different types of insurance plans. For example, there are private insurance policies, which include group plans from employment and unions. There's also policies available through the Affordable Care Act at the state marketplace, and also Medicare and Medicaid. The type of plan you have is going to determine the type of laws and rules that apply regarding coverage, eligibility, and appeals. And the insurance laws of your state may also require certain minimum benefits, so your rights may also vary depending on where you live. As a start, the most important advice I can give is to read a copy of your policy. It's important to understand if your policy is an HMO, which allows only in-network doctors, or a PPO or POS, which allows for out-of-network doctors, but often at a reduced reimbursement rate. With an HMO, you usually have a copayment and sometimes a deductible, but no other financial burden if your doctor is in-network. With other policies, your out-of-network doctor can bill you directly for any amount not paid for by your insurance. So understanding the policy can help you make informed decisions about your medical care and avoid surprise bills. Because of the Affordable Care Act's increased protections, insurers must sell and renew insurance regardless of health status. Most insurers can no longer refuse coverage of pre-existing conditions like cancer, and insurance companies can't limit the dollar amount they'll pay for medical costs over the year or your lifetime. Additionally, a health insurance marketplace operates in every state where you can compare different plan benefits, see if you're entitled to lower your costs through subsidies, and determine if you're eligible for free coverage under Medicaid. You can access this information at the federal site, healthcare.gov, where you can compare policies and costs and find answers to many of your questions. Essential health benefits are covered in these plans, which include outpatient and emergency services, prescriptions, hospitalizations, mental health, preventive care, and more. But it's important to remember that even with the Affordable Care Act expansions, all policies can still restrict coverage by limiting the number of, let's say, physical therapy visits, home nursing, or mental health visits allowed per year. Major medical procedures or tests may require pre-authorization, so it's important to check with your doctor's office to confirm. Health insurance is essentially a contract. You and your employer agree to pay a set premium, participate in cost sharing, and follow the guidelines. And in return, your health insurer agrees to cover certain services in your policy. And your insurance company must provide you with a copy if you ask for it. The most important advice I can give is that although it can be daunting, you should read a copy of your summary of benefits, which breaks down your cost sharing and the basics of your policy, as well as a certificate of coverage, which outlines your benefits, any coverage limits or exclusions, pre-authorization requirements, and the appeals process. If you're a student, your college may also offer help and coverage, although some of these policies do have limitations, so it's important to ask in advance for a copy and read through it to make sure it'll meet all of your health insurance needs. Under the Affordable Care Act, a person can continue to be covered under their parents' health insurance until age 21, so this may be an option. And if a parent is working, work-based health insurance is often more comprehensive coverage. So a little bit about Medicaid. Now, eligibility rules for Medicaid are established mainly by each state, and they vary depending on where you live. Medicaid is free, and to be eligible, you must fall below the income and asset limits set forth by Medicaid law. Medicaid plans with higher income limits are also offered in many states for patients with certain types of cancer or for working people with disabilities. And as I mentioned earlier, one application on the marketplace can determine your eligibility for Medicaid or other health insurance, as well as any subsidies for premiums. Next, I'm going to give an overview of the laws protecting against discrimination based on disability in school, work, and during medical leave. And I'll also talk about what to do if you believe you're being discriminated against at work. My focus will be on the federal laws that apply to all 50 states, but I urge you to become familiar with your state laws as they often provide even greater protections than the federal laws. If you are still in school, you may be protected by Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which forbids organizations that receive federal funding from excluding or denying individuals with disabilities an equal opportunity to receive program benefits and services. And this law applies to primary, secondary schools and colleges. Colleges have individualized policies for medical leaves of absence, so it's hard to discuss them generally here because they're varied, but these policies outline the steps you need to take to maintain or reinstate your federal aid upon your return. Typically, federal student aid, such as Pell Grants and direct loans, are affected by enrollment status, and if you take a leave of absence, especially if it extends beyond a certain period, your enrollment status may change. If you drop below half-time enrollment, it could affect your eligibility for certain types of federal aid or school-based health insurance. Colleges and universities typically have disability services offices that work with students to determine appropriate accommodations based on their individual needs. Therefore, it's crucial to communicate with your college's financial aid and disability services office as soon as you anticipate the need for a leave of absence or an accommodation. They can provide guidance on the specific impact on your financial aid and help you understand any procedures or paperwork. If you're working, I want to urge everyone to make sure to review the specific policies of your employer for medical leave and disability pay, as these often will vary. Every employer should provide a summary of company policies and benefits, and these policies may offer even greater protections than the laws I will be discussing. I'm going to begin with a law I'm sure most of you have heard of, and Dr. Monick also mentioned, the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA. This is a federal law that applies to everyone who works for an employer with 15 or more employees. To be eligible for protection, you must have a disability, which is defined as having an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, such as walking, working, eating, or sleeping, but the law specifically covers a cancer diagnosis. The ADA has two main benefits. The first benefit is that it requires an employer to make reasonable accommodations when requested by an employee. This empowers employees to request changes in their schedule, work environment, or company policies. Reasonableness is case specific, but employers must comply unless it poses an exceptionally challenging burden, which is hard for them to prove, and additional costs don't always qualify as an undue hardship. I always suggest that the accommodation request be made in writing with a letter of support from your doctor certifying that the accommodation is medically necessary, but that you're able to continue to perform the essential functions of your job. Some common accommodations include additional break time, shorter work hours, even time off can be a reasonable request, and as Dr. Monick mentioned, working remotely, either part-time or full-time. The second ADA benefit is that the law prohibits discrimination against an employee because of a disability or perceived disability. If a person's able to do their job and has an accommodation in place or needs time off, an employer can't take action that adversely affects their job, such as termination or demotion. So the ADA protects somebody who has disclosed to their employer, you know, that they're working with a disability. They're protected from adverse action based on their disability. The next law I want to discuss is the Family Medical Leave Act, often known as FMLA. FMLA applies to employers with 50 or more employees, and to be covered, you must have worked at your job for 12 months and for 1,250 hours in the last year. If an employee qualifies, they're entitled to 12 weeks of job-protected leave every 12 months. This can also be intermittent leave, which means that you can take time off as needed for doctor's appointments and medical needs, rather than taking it off in a large chunk of time. FMLA leave is unpaid but can be combined with sick time or short-term disability, and FMLA time off can be requested to care for yourself or a family member, such as a spouse or child. An ADA accommodation can only be requested for yourself. And also, if you work for a smaller company and you don't qualify for FMLA, time off for treatment can also be requested as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA, as I mentioned before. Lastly, I also want to address disclosure under both the ADA and FMLA and as it relates to discrimination. Deciding to disclose your cancer diagnosis is a really personal decision, and you have control over who should be aware of your health situation and when. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, disclosure occurs in three distinct phases. So the first is pre-employment, when you're, let's say, in a job interview, interviewing for a new job. During this period, employers can't ask health-related questions during the interview, but they can inquire about your ability to perform duties with or without an accommodation. And no pre-employment medical exams are allowed. The next phase is the job offer, and employers can condition offers on passing a medical exam, but this applies uniformly to anybody entering this job position. In this phase, truthfulness and responses is essential, and job offers can be revoked. They can't be revoked based on disability, but they could be revoked if false information was provided during a pre-employment medical exam. And third, while employed, employers can't mandate medical exams or disability-related questions unless they're job-related and necessary for business. And there's exceptions for certain safety-sensitive roles, such as, you know, people that work in public safety, but generally, while employed, disclosure is not required. And in summary, disclosure is really only necessary when you're asking for an ADA accommodation or FMLA leave. And even in those circumstances, it's important to decide who you want to disclose to. And my advice is usually to go to HR if there is a human resources, because that's the group that's, you know, trained to understand what your rights are in their workplace and their responsibilities. And even supervisors in your job sometimes don't have the knowledge about rights and responsibilities in the workplace. So despite these legal safeguards, discrimination persists due to misunderstandings. HR is the first step, and if issues persist, filing an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission complaint is an option. Also check your state laws for additional protections and always consult a lawyer for guidance before taking any action. Practically, understanding benefits, review the summary of benefits, and know the medical leave policy. Address discrimination proactively, consider ADA accommodations, and carefully decide on disclosure. I know this is a lot of information, and I encourage listeners to take the time to educate themselves about these laws and regulations, as well as your state laws, and seek out resources such as Cancer Care to have a better understanding of your rights and the protections available to you. So thank you, and I look forward to any follow-up questions.
Oh, thank you so much. So that was just an outstanding presentation, stellar, and just so much information. And I do want to remind everyone that we do offer these programs. Within a week will be a podcast, and they're up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for at least a year, if not longer. And so you'll be able to listen to it again if you want to, and you'll also be able to call our staff at Cancer Care for more information as well. Thank you so much, Ms. Slough. That was just outstanding, though. So much wonderful information. And our next speaker is Ms. Melody Griffith, and Ms. Griffith is an oncology social worker, outpatient adolescent and young adult AYA oncology social worker, and she's instructor in social work, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science, section of social work, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Ms. Griffith will be addressing the role of the oncology social worker in the young adult cancer programs, guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Griffith.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for hanging with us this long. I know it's a lot of information, and hopefully you're getting some good tidbits out of it and can re-listen if you need to. So like she said, I'm a social worker specializing in helping young adults through the cancer experience. And in my role, I support patients and families through the emotional, practical, and informational challenges that may come up during cancer treatment and well into survivorship as well. Social workers in oncology are about as diverse as patients in oncology, as was mentioned earlier, about young adults who are each individual. So the way we are used in various facilities is different. So you may or may not have a social worker. I think most places do, but we may have different approaches. But what I do and what most adolescent and young adult social workers do is to help navigate things like returning to work or school, managing finances, coping emotionally, finding community resources, helping you advocate for yourself with your healthcare team, and sometimes just bridging those gaps that may be perceived or real with your team or with family members or other support system members. So part of my role is helping you feel confident to ask questions and actively participate in your care. So when you're having a visit with your provider, it is great to be prepared, as some of our speakers have talked about, especially when it's a telehealth visit. Technology is wonderful, but there's also things that can sometimes go wrong pretty easily. So it's great first to make sure that your device is fully charged, that you've got a great internet connection, that the software is up to date. I can't tell you how many times I've logged into my own appointments and have to update software. So we understand, but if you can check that ahead of time, that would be great. Also, practice logging in. If you've never had a telehealth visit with this particular provider or institution before, give it a practice beforehand so that you're familiar with the process and not kind of scrambling last minute, adding to the probable distress you might already feel before an appointment with your doctor or another healthcare person. Have a backup plan, because some places provide phone numbers in case you get disconnected or you can't get through. They may even call you and help you through the process. So be willing and ready to talk with them a little bit ahead of time of your appointment if possible. And then, as it was said earlier, it's really great to have a list of questions ahead of time, because I don't know about you, but sometimes thinking on my feet isn't the easiest, especially if you're feeling overwhelmed or got new information that maybe you weren't expecting or didn't know was coming your way that day. So writing down the questions ahead of time is a big help so that you can articulate them so that you don't miss something that you were hoping to maybe talk about with your doctor or other provider. Don't be afraid to bring up personal concerns either, like how treatment affects school or work or relationships. You might catch your provider off guard, but we know that these are important pieces of who you are well beyond the cancer diagnosis, and they are so important to your healing, to your treatment, to your survivorship that we need to know about them. And we can be really great at our jobs, but we're not really great mind readers. And so if you don't ask these questions, we might not know, and we might not know to ask too. Some providers are super great about asking questions that could be uncomfortable, and some are not. So it might be up to you to stand up for yourself and say, hey, I have these questions and I'm wondering about this. And chances are that somebody else has asked those questions before. You're not going to be the alien in the room that has something happening that nobody else has. But it's just a great idea to be able to have that open communication with your provider, or send a portal message later, or an email, or however you communicate best with your team. If you think of something after the fact, that's okay too. But bringing up these things in every junction of your care is important, because we know transition times between scans, or when treatment changes, or when you finish treatment, or something else comes up. Those are important, and all of those things could change and be affected in different ways at those different times. So it's not like you've asked it once and that's it, that's your only chance. Please keep asking us and make us talk about it. Make us uncomfortable if we seem uncomfortable. We want to help you, and sometimes we just need your help in knowing how to do that to the best way that we can. Also, another thing that might be helpful is involving a support person in your office visit or your virtual visit. So you may want a family member or a friend, somebody that you trust, or somebody that maybe you know can take good notes for you while you're just soaking everything in. Having two sets of ears is sometimes helpful to hear what's being said. But on the converse, it's also okay if you have an overbearing family member or friend or partner, and you want a private time with your provider, either virtually or in person. It's okay to set that boundary and say, this is my appointment and I appreciate your willingness to sit in with me, but I need this time on my own with my provider to talk about my plan or what's going to happen next. So that's important too. So you can have people when you want to, and you can decide to do it on your own also. Just remember that it's up to you to be able to define what that appointment looks like. And then using the patient portal, if your provider or office has one, is great, where you can review notes. I think a lot of it's written in doctorese, but you can kind of make sense of some of it. And if something doesn't make sense, you can send a message and ask, can you clarify this? What does this mean? Or ask in your next appointment. Those are all really important things to take into consideration so that you understand what was discussed and what you have going forward and what the plan should be. So remember, appointments, that even when they're virtual, they are your time with your team. Take a breath, ask for clarification, ask for additional options and choices. It's your care and you deserve to feel informed and that you have a say in that appointment and with your treatment plan. If you need support, whether emotional or practical, please ask if there's a social worker you can talk to or another care team member. Navigating cancer, we know, is a lot, regardless of age, but being young and in really the prime of life adds to these additional layers to what you're already going through. And we know that healthcare in general is making efforts to improve the care available to you, and we hope that all young adults going through cancer and survivorship feel seen and supported. That is our goal, and that's why we're grateful for opportunities like this to get information to you all to know how to work best with your care team. I really appreciate your time and listening to us today and hope that you get some good information out of this, and we are open to questions here in a little bit.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Griffith. That was just a wonderful presentation, chock full of information. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Matthew Markin, and Matthew is Program and Community Coordinator of Stupid Cancer, and he'll be addressing Stupid Cancer's free programs and services, and he'll be providing you how to connect with Stupid Cancer as well. So it's my great pleasure to turn this program over to the partner organization on today's program and to Matthew Marroquin.
Hello. So my name is Matthew Marroquin. I'm the Program Community Coordinator here at Stupid Cancer. So I'm going to tell you a little about our mission, what Stupid Cancer does, and all that fun stuff. So Stupid Cancer helps empower everyone affected by adolescent and young adult cancer, which is ages 15 to 39, by ending isolation, build a community, and we build to really support all AYAs to feel understood and accepted. So we have a bunch of different programs. I'm just going to kind of rapidly go through them as fast as I can. Our first one is CancerCon, which is held once a year. This is a big conference that AYAs, hundreds of AYAs, come together for breakout sessions to meet different people, to talk about various cancer topics like sex and intimacy, mental health, insurance paperwork, a lot of things we're talking about today, also just like an amazing social experience. This next year, it's going to be in D.C., August 21 to the 24th, so definitely come out. We also hold a lot of virtual discussion sessions where, like this, we talk about a topic or two and really go into it, but it really leaves the room open for others to discuss among each other. We also have Stupid Cancer Stories, which is a great way to share your cancer story. Whether you're a writer, you want to record it, we can submit it, and we'll share it on our story library. And finally, we have our meetups. We have a variety of both digital and live meetups every month so that we can make other friends who get it. We actually partner with Cancer Care quite often. I think that Haley will touch on later too, where we have like NYC meetups. But then also we have a lot of digital meetups. Our next one is this Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern time. We always have one on Monday throughout the entire year. And you can find out more about us or a bunch of other resources that, you know, Cancer Care, among many other organizations, are on at stupidcancer.org. So feel free to check us out.
Thank you so much, Ms. Marquardt. It's a wonderful resource. Many of you may know of it, but for those of you who don't, please check it out. It's a wonderful resource, and we're delighted to be partnering with you on this program today. Thank you. And our next speaker is Haley Fuchs, and Haley Fuchs is the Young Adult Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. She's an oncology social worker, and she'll be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services and talk to you about our Hope Line and our website as well. So I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Fuchs.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As Dr. Messner mentioned, my name is Haley Fuchs. I'm the Young Adult Program Coordinator at Cancer Care, and I'd like to take this opportunity to address the psychosocial impact that a cancer diagnosis can have on the YA population and highlight some of Cancer Care's programs that can be of assistance. And before I get started, I just want to provide a brief review of Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. I'm going to provide a brief review of our services. Cancer diagnosis can be, of course, very overwhelming, and additional support and guidance may help relieve feelings of anxiety. Working one-on-one with an oncology social worker through individual counseling can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. Cancer Care offers free cancer-focused counseling to individuals impacted by cancer for those who live in New York and New Jersey. And joining a support group can also be a great way of getting additional support through this time. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others, gather and provide support, as well as obtain information. Cancer Care offers online support groups for young adults across the country. These groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website. We are currently offering a few groups specifically for young adults. We have a group for young adults diagnosed with cancer, as well as young adult caregivers and young adults who have lost a loved one to cancer. Young adults diagnosed with cancer may experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment, as we highlighted in this series. It may be helpful to discuss any financial concerns with medical providers, social workers, patient navigators, as well as the financial department at the treatment center to see if there are any financial options that are available to you. Cancer Care offers some limited financial assistance to young adults with certain diagnoses who qualify as well. Cancer Care also offers free telephone resource navigation to young adults living with cancer, those who are post-treatment survivors and caregivers. These services are provided by professional resource navigators and oncology social workers and are available in English and Spanish. Resource navigation centers on the practical challenges that arise from cancer, and staff provide clients with resources, referrals, and potential financial assistance options. Cancer Care is now offering an online tool as well called My Trialist that provides information on clinical trials. Finally, on Cancer Care's website, there's also a wide array of reading material and information related to young adults coping with cancer. This includes some recorded Connect education workshops, also Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, multiple publications, as well as stories of help and hope in both general and specific resources. We also have Coping Circle workshops specifically. We have an upcoming Coping Circle called Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Chronicles, which will take place in April of 2025. And then we have the previous year's chronicles recorded as well that you can definitely watch. We also have an upcoming free young adult writing workshop on January 29th. And if you're interested in learning more about our supportive services or any other services that Cancer Care offers, I encourage you to explore our website and also to call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak on this program. And I'll now turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Fuchs. That was a wonderful presentation, wonderful resources for people. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Regina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And this question for Dr. Bender. What advice do you have for young adult survivors dealing with thoughts about recurrence?
So I think we heard a lot of options for young adults. I think that as a physician, we can do our best to reassure, but my answer is always, it's a new normal. I wish I could tell you that that fear would go away. All I can do is validate that it is appropriate. But I think the best people to help you deal with those thoughts are actually people who have similar thoughts. And that's where I think these adolescent and young adult programming, either that's available at the institution where you're treated or is available through Cancer Care or Stupid Cancer or one of the outside organizations, would be really helpful, because I think peer support is probably the best form of support, especially moderated peer support.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. So this question for Ms. Wolf. I was in the middle of transitioning jobs. I left my job and was basically in interviews for a new job. Then I found out that I had cancer. I stopped the interview process because I was afraid that this cancer will be a long process. My question is, will it be illegal to take a new job, a new full-time job, while I know I have cancer and will go on surgeries in a month from now? Then perhaps I will have chemotherapy. How will you approach how will you approach this to a new employer?
So, you know, my first advice is always talk with your medical team and, you know, get their recommendations about working and see if, you know, working through your treatment is feasible, at least at this point in your treatment. A person, as I mentioned before, a person does not have to disclose during a job interview. And my advice is usually not to disclose, get the job, and then ask for reasonable accommodations. There's no time that you have to be working before you're entitled to reasonable accommodations. But remember that it's different with FMLA, which is what provides job protected leave. You have to be working at your job for a year and for a certain amount of hours before you're eligible for job protected leave. So, and just also remember that accommodation requests have to be reasonable. So I think if somebody, if a person gets a new job and they might need some minimal time off for a medical reason, then that's a reasonable accommodation. However, if somebody gets a, you know, is, takes a job knowing that they're going to need a larger period of time off, let's say for surgery, for recovery, for aftercare, it may be the time to think about whether or not this is, you know, the timing for a new job. It really is a case-by-case basis. As I said before, you don't have to disclose during the job interview, but in order to be entitled to job protected leave for that 12-month period, you do have to be working for a year. So, again, case-by-case basis, though.
Thank you so much. And I just remind everyone that we have another program next Friday on December 13th, Cancer in the Workplace, Health Insurance, Finances, and Returning to School. Now, I'm going to ask each of our speakers to provide a takeaway for all of you for today's program. And I'm going to start with Dr. Bender, if she would just provide a brief takeaway to everybody.
I think the brief takeaway is make sure that you're very comfortable with your cancer care team, that it is holistic, that you're able to ask your questions and get answers and be directed to the resources that you need.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Monique.
Yes, okay. So I think my biggest takeaway is that knowledge is truly power. And it's important to be proactive with what you need out of your care, because your care team isn't necessarily going to know that. And as good and holistic as we try to be, sometimes we do drop the ball when it comes to things like asking about how we're doing with body image, sexual health, or mental health. So if you're struggling, let us know so we can connect you to the right resources.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Wolf.
So I think I have to agree with Dr. Monick to educate yourself, to understand what your rights in the workplace are as well as what your responsibilities are, and also to educate yourself in your benefits and your health insurance by, as difficult as I know it is, by reading your policy, understanding your policy, and understanding what your rights are. You'll be far better equipped to handle anything that comes up.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Griffith, your takeaway.
Your time with your provider, so that whether that be appointments or messages or phone calls, is yours. So take some ownership of that. Come prepared. Be ready to talk with them. Know that you can ask questions. And as it's been reiterated, ask for help from any team member that is available to you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Excellent advice. And Mr. Markhorn?
Of course. Our side of things is definitely more, you're not going through this alone either. There's other people who get it, and that's why Stupid Cancer is here. We're here to bring together those people. That way you don't have to go through this alone. You don't have to go through the deals of body image, of the reoccurrence, of this, of that, of health insurance alone. You can join us for events, for conversations, and be open about it with others who understand exactly what's going on. If not maybe exactly, at least has a similar experience. So that's my last takeaway for this.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Hughes.
Yeah, I would say it's so important to reach out for help and support. And just what Matthew said, you know, you're not alone. There are so many amazing organizations and also so many young adult specific organizations and resources that can, you know, provide support to you and your loved ones. So just don't forget that, you know, we're here to support you.
Excellent. Wow. This has been an amazing program. I have to say, although, you know, we're doing another one next week, but I want to say that this has been a phenomenal program. And although we were not able to answer all your questions, because there are so many people on the call today, I want to say something about that. For those of you who got to ask a question, I actually want to thank both our speakers and our participants for just being on the call today and for all that you said. And so for those of you who got to ask a question, for those of you who have a question yet to ask, please, all of you, go back to Treating Healthcare team. Of course, they know you the best. You've also learned a lot on today's program. So please take what you've learned back to your Treating Healthcare team. And they will, of course, be able to address your questions. Remember, you've learned a lot on the program today. Also, I just want to remind all of you that we're coming into a holiday season. And a holiday season means that although you can reach people during the day, although sometimes on a holiday may be difficult, please check with your healthcare team who is available evenings, weekends, and holidays. That's really important that you have that information. That's really very important. And I guess I want to just thank all of you for your participating in this program today. I look forward to your being on the program next week. Next Friday, you'll be getting a reminder about that. And again, I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.